Welcome to the For Our Babies podcast. For Our Babies is a nationwide campaign calling for better beginnings for our babies. This podcast features conversations about infant development and topics related to the For Our Babies campaign. I'm your host, Julie Weatherston.
Today's episode, Professional Expectations Without Professional Conditions. In this episode, For Our Babies founder, Dr. Ron Lally, from the Center for Child and Family Studies at WestEd, talks with Marcy Whitebook from the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment at the University of California, Berkeley, about the current state of infant-toddler workforce conditions.
Hi, Marcy.
Hi, Ron.
I'd love to talk with you a little bit about your latest study.
Well, we released a study last year called Worthy Work, Still on Livable Wages. And the study was really a look at what had happened around childcare jobs over the last 25 years. In 1989, we had released a study called the National Childcare Staffing Study.
I remember and that study.
Yeah, and that was really the first study that made the link between poor pay in early childhood and poor work environments and poor quality for children. And that study was followed by several other studies that pointed out the problems with low wages in early childhood and how that made it difficult to attract and retain highly skilled people to work with young children, and how really when programs had really high turnover and paid low wages, they weren't able to improve their quality over time or sustain quality over time. So we were thinking, well, okay, it's been 25 years and there's been so much growth in our knowledge as a country and as in the world really about the importance of the first few years of life. And there's been so many efforts in California and across the country to try and improve quality. We wanted to see what's really been happening to the early childhood workforce.
Well, one of the things that we do at the center is that we deal with that quality issue, training people and kind of recommending primary caregivers and continuity of care so that children would have relationships and attachment connections, secondary attachment connections with their caregivers. And one of the things I'm interested in is how does the wage issue impact that continuity? Are you seeing that people are staying more within the workforce with the same children as in the past?
Well, we didn't really look at that question per se, but we do know that when wages are low in early childhood, then the turnover goes up. And, you know, we did have in the 2008-09, we had a little slowing of turnover because the economy was so bad, so people weren't going to leave their jobs. But whenever the economy starts to pick up, then early childhood turnover goes up. And of course, for infants and toddlers, the time in life where we want to see the most continuity between children and their caregivers, we're paying teachers and caregivers the least. So it's much harder to keep people working with infants and toddlers because really the people doing the work can't sustain themselves and their families. And one of the things that's really disturbing is that even when teachers who are working with infants and toddlers have the same level of education as kindergarten teachers or teachers working with preschoolers, they earn, you know, maybe 60% of the wages of those
teachers. You know, I heard you speak once, and that was startling to me, that a person has a BA, but because they're working with infants and toddlers, they're making less than a BA with a preschooler or kindergarten teacher.
Right. And the thing is that the system we have for paying people in early childhood is highly irrational, because really what you're paid is not based on your qualifications. It's based on the setting you're in and the age of children that you work with. So if you work with the babies and toddlers, you're going to get less than if you work with the preschoolers. But if you work with preschoolers in a state-sponsored pre-K program, you're going to earn more than if you're working with preschoolers in Head Start or in child care. So we have a system that really isn't equitable for the people doing the work, and it increasingly we're understanding how complex the work is, and we're raising the educational expectations for people working in early childhood. And yet, you know, someone who gets a degree in early childhood can face a lifetime of very low earnings. And the difference over a lifetime between an infant toddler teacher and a kindergarten teacher could be over $500,000 over a 30-year period.
And what we've learned about the development of the brain and early foundation of the creation of a sense of self and sense of others and character development is all of that is robust during the first couple of years of life. Right. And so what you're saying is during this very fertile period, we have people working with children who are not being compensated fairly.
Right, and I think, you know, one thing to think about, if we looked at the science, we would be paying infant and toddler teachers more, you know, on a par with any other teachers, if not even more, in terms of how important that stage of development is. But I think a lot of people know that working with young children is poorly paid, but I don't think people realize how poorly paid it is. So that's one of the things our study looks at. The current infant and toddler teaching workforce experiences the lowest wages of teachers of any age child, earning a fraction of what their equally educated counterparts teaching preschool and elementary school earn, with a median wage of only $11.40 per hour for those who hold a bachelor's degree or higher. You know, and of course, most don't hold a bachelor's
right.
degree, so that means that they're really living close to poverty. And one of the things our study looked at was what the level of economic insecurity amongst teachers of young children and also the use of federal income support. So we can't break that out specifically about infant and toddler teachers, but we know that they are the lowest paid in the early childhood workforce. So in one study we recently did looking at economic worry, you know, close to half the people working in these childcare centers were worrying about having enough food for their own family. So the shame of what we do in this country is we talk about early childhood as a way to ameliorate poverty, but in fact we're generating poverty for early childhood teachers and their families. And 46% of the people who are childcare workers, which includes a lot of the people working with babies and toddlers, utilize some kind of federal income support, whether it's food stamps or earned income tax credit, Medicaid, whatever. And, you know, that has costs. It's in California, that alone costs, you know, $275 million a year. But it's really, you know, very troubling to think about how economically vulnerable these families are. And for the childcare workers who have children under five, the utilization rates are even higher for federal income support. So, you know, if you step back and you think, what is it like to spend your day working with other people's children and trying to facilitate their learning and development, in the back of your mind wondering, how are you going to feed your family? Or how are you going to pay if your car breaks down? Or are you going to get evicted?
Well, I can imagine. The stress level that those people are under can preoccupy them so much that they can't be present for the baby. Mm-hmm. And the level of tension that they might carry around in their bodies, in their minds. They could be short with the children, they could be zoned out thinking of these other things.
Or they may hold it together while they're at work, and then when they go home, you know, they're stressed with their own children, or they get sick, or, you know, whatever it is. And we also know that in the programs where people are paid the lowest, you see the lowest ratings of quality, you know, and where you see the most worry, you see the lowest ratings of quality. So I think that there's just this misalignment of what we know and how our system is organized. So, you know, I sometimes try and step back and take a historical look at this. So, you know, our early childhood system started 100 years ago, mm-hmm. roughly. And at that point in time, really, we thought good care for infants and toddlers was just making sure that they were clean and healthy and free from disease. But we didn't really understand the complexity of development or the skill it took to do the work. But we now have had that information for several decades now. And I think that there should be more urgency about trying to right this and make these good jobs, as opposed to thinking we can continue to try and provide quality care on the backs of people who themselves are just struggling to make it with their own families.
Do you think there's denial about this in our society, that there's this illusion that the children are getting good care?
Well, I think it's interesting because the National Association for the Education of Young Children just did a poll of likely voters, and they asked them about early educators. And I think people know that working with young children is not well paid, just like people know that teaching is, you don't go into teaching if you're trying to make, of any age child, if you're trying to make a lot of money. But I don't think people realize how poorly paid they are. And I think part of that is because, you know, in the United States, the way we've organized infant toddler care is that parents primarily foot the bill for it. We don't see it as a public good. We don't even see preschool as a public good for most families. So what that means is that parents experience care as an enormously expensive. You know, it takes a big bite out of their budget. And so, and then they may look and think, well, I'm paying these teachers, I'm paying this much. You know, they, it's hard to connect the dots between how much they're paying and how low paid people are. So I think people are aware of it, but I don't think they understand the depths of the poverty that a lot of early childhood teachers faced and the consequences for care.
And it's so expensive that, that the parents want to keep it low.
Yeah.
In the For Our Babies book, we looked at care of infants and toddlers in other countries and found that 80% of it was subsidized either federally by the state or by the municipality, where in the United States, 20% of it was subsidized. And so when you're dealing with ratios of 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 that you need in order to have of intimate connections, that's very expensive to have so few children.
With one adult.
Right. And it's one of the things that because it's on the parents' shoulders to pay for this, that they want to keep the cost low.
Right.
And we recommend we have to have a subsidy.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have to break the link between what parents pay for child care and how much people are paid. We basically need a third party payer. And you know, if you look at the military, which has the best early childhood system in the country, that's exactly what they have. People in the military pay no more than, I think it's 8 or 10% of their income towards child care. And then there's a pay scale. The early childhood teachers are on a federal pay scale. Then somebody picks up what's in between. You know, imagine if we asked parents to pay for first, second, and third grade, we'd have we'd have a similar problem. So I think it's a question of public will about if we think this is important, we think this is what children need, we know parents need this to work, we know children need really good care in order to succeed in life, and then we have to say, well, it's worth the investment. And of course, there's all this research that comes out and says, well, you get the return on the investment later on, but I don't think people, you know, act on return on investment. They act on right now. And
yes, but it's because it's not subsidized.
That's right.
I mean, they individually have to pay for it.
Right.
I mean, what we need is a view of the infant as a citizen of our society rather than the property of the parent, and you're completely responsible.
Right. And, you know, we also don't have paid family leave.
Right.
So, it's interesting because during World War II, the United States set up child care centers because so many women came into the labor force. And by and large, they were pretty good quality because there was really a focus on development and meeting the child's need and meeting the family's need.
They even gave meals to the people to
take home. Yeah, you could bring your dry cleaning in or your laundry service or whatever. But 6 days after the war, President Truman said, we're going to close child care centers. And people fought in various communities to keep them open. California was actually one of the places that eventually the state took them over. But, you know, in Europe, it was a very different thing because in the United States, people were saying, we have to close the child care centers. We have to get women out of the workforce because the men are coming home. Those are their jobs. Well, in Europe, they basically had lost so many men during the war that they said, well, we need women to have babies and we need them to work. So how are we going to make that happen? And there was more of an attitude towards thinking about, you know, both sides of the equation. What could make it work better for parents? And also, how do you make sure you get good services for young children? And, you know, I think we've seen over the last 50 years that women, you know, are in the workforce. I mean, when I was young, right after college, that was just starting to happen. I mean, it had been going on for many years for many, many women, but more and more women, including middle-class women, started entering the workforce. And I think, you know, I talk to young people on my staff, you know, they're 30 years younger than I am, and
they're facing the same situation I faced when I had a kid about there's no infant toddler care. They're trying to piece together how do you work full time when you have a baby when there's no real parental leave and there's no good infant toddler care. Sometimes I think what we have to do is figure out how to tap into people's frustration about this and really get this much more in the public consciousness.
I also think that we have to have a society of ownership conversation about who is this child, you know, mm-hmm. what is this child going to be in our society? And if we want character development, if we want good citizens, it starts early on, and we need to see the investment. Heckman and other economists have, as you've said, they've told us it's going to pay off in the long run.
Right.
But it's not just in the economics. It's going to pay off in better citizens.
It's interesting. I had a conversation with, you know, a very prominent early childhood advocate who basically said to me, basically, Marcy, people don't care about childcare workers. They care about their own child. They want whatever will make their child competitive in the world. And I understand that everybody, every parent wants what's best for their child. But what we have to sort of move to is an understanding that if my kid does okay, but your kid doesn't do okay, then in the end, that's not going to work for my kid either. And that really understanding that it's in my interest to have all the children in my community thriving, because that's going to be what the community is when my child grows up. I think some people think that, but people are so beaten down now by low wages and economic insecurity and some of the fear-mongering that goes on, that really people are sort of looking out for themselves and not understanding that when we don't have a community response, we weaken it for everybody.
I also think that even those people who are looking out for themselves, they don't get that the care they're getting often isn't as good as they think. I mean, there is this whitewashing as I drop my child off and I think everything's going to be fine. Because there's a guilt if it's not fine.
I don't know if you remember these studies way back when we were young,
yes.
younger, where they would ask parents about their childcare arrangements and if they liked their childcare arrangements, and parents would say yes, they were satisfied with their childcare arrangements. And all these people were saying they were satisfied with their childcare arrangements. Then if you asked parents, if you had an opportunity to change your childcare, would you? And the same people said, in a New York minute, I would. And so I think what that is if you have to leave your child someplace, and this is the only place you can find, or this is the only place you can afford, you can't really tolerate thinking that it's not good because it's just too painful.
I did a book in the early 80s for the National Institute of Mental Health, and I was interviewing parents in the Bay Area, San Francisco mm-hmm. Bay Area. And one of the parents, I'll never forget what she said, she says, it doesn't bother me that I have to leave my child in care. It bothers me that I have to leave my child in this bad quality care, mm-hmm. but I have to work and I don't have an option.
Yeah.
And she was one of the few that was really honest and kind of pulled the veil from her eyes. And when I was visiting child care centers then, we saw horrible situations.
Mm-hmm. When we were doing the National Child Care Staffing Study, you know, we had a group of researchers that went out into all these cities collecting data, and I would get these calls from the research assistants that were coming, and they were going like, I can't do this anymore. I can't, you know, what I'm seeing is so disturbing. And I would sort of have to control people and say, look, you have to, because the only way we can get information out about how bad it is if we can document how bad it is. And we would have conversations about at what point do you have to call Child Protective Services or licensing, like what's the line? So people would have to tell me what they saw, and then we would sort of determine if that has to happen. And, you know, it was interesting to me that a lot of what was disturbing to people, and I found this later when I had a job where I was going around visiting child care centers too, was that what was disturbing was seeing the kids wandering aimlessly and just not having any attention. It wasn't necessarily that children were being hurt or yelled at, but you just saw this wasted potential in front of your eyes. Here was this curious little toddler who sort of, the light had gone out of their eyes because there was no one responding to them, or you'd walk into a place and some kid would just glom onto you because they wanted somebody to pay attention to them. And you know, we're so immersed in it. But what will it take to get people to see that this is a national crisis, that we're really allowing our youngest children to be in situations that are harmful.
Well, I thought that the brain development research was going to do that. I was very optimistic when From Norris to Neighborhoods came out, that finally that what we had is the National Academies of Science saying, you know, this is an important period. We need to put a lot of resources in here. There's going to be payoff later on. And I'm still not seeing that. And I think it's because the structure is still parents pay the bulk of the money. And when you have that few children with one caregiver, it's going to be too expensive. And so what they do is anything they can to cut the cost. And it's a systemic issue that needs to be dealt with systemically. I mean, our recommendations for our babies are really clear. It can't be put on the backs of the parents exclusively. It has to be done through a combination of business, municipal, state, and federal contributions to the care.
And right now, really, it's on the backs of the parents and on the child care workers. Child care workers are subsidizing parents through their low wages, you know, so that in early childhood, an early childhood teacher 25 years ago and now earns about 60% of what comparably educated women earn and about 30% of what comparably educated men earn.
So let's talk a little bit about the impact on the child.
Okay.
I mean, one of the things that we're seeing is the stress level that the caregivers are under is impacting their ability to be present. Are you able to, in your research, to pick up some of this, or is that a little bit too subtle?
Well, you know, a number of years ago, we did some research looking at indicators of depression. Uh-huh. So there's like a screening you can do, and it doesn't tell you for sure you're depressed, but the responses are, in a certain way, consistent with a diagnosis of depression, right? So when we would see in those programs where the caregivers or the teachers seemed to be expressing opinions that were correlated with depression, you saw lower quality. And several people have found that. We're now trying to, in the current study we're going to be doing in Alameda County, we're actually going to be looking at adult well-being, both economic and sort of issues of equity and fairness and sort of workplace policies that support adults' healthy behaviors, and looking at depression, and then looking at quality to see what kind of relationships we see with that. So it's a tricky thing because I do feel like there's so much disparaging of people who work with the youngest children, you know, and part of that comes from because a lot of people are underprepared and they're undersupported, so they may not be doing it very well. On the other hand, you know, there are a lot of people who are actually pretty well supported or well prepared, and they're doing the best they can. It's the same thing as like when we blame children, poor children, for being a certain way, or we blame people for circumstances when the context of their lives is partially what's creating the problem. So I think both things are true. The stress can really impact the way teachers are interacting with kids, but I also sometimes think that the stress, the teachers are rallying when the kids are there, and that the stress is taking a toll on their health. Some people just leave. They protest with their feet. They go, I'm not getting what I need here. I just can't keep doing this. I think other people just take it in their bodies, basically. You know, they try to do the best with kids, but, you know, their health is compromised. You know, I think we have to really think about how we've raised these expectations, and we're rating programs now all the time, and we're asking people to fill out these assessments. And so we've made teaching young children higher stakes. And we've also added new components to the work in terms of certain kinds of reporting on the children and assessments, those kinds of things. But we haven't changed the jobs in any way to allow people to do that. So everybody's always talking about reflection time and planning time and teacher sharing time. But we don't, in early childhood, ever pay people for time when children aren't there. So they're doing these things while the kids are napping, or they're doing them, you know, they're supposed to be watching the kids in the playground and planning or talking to their coach. I mean, so we just are sort of upping the expectations and the responsibilities on teachers, and we're not giving them the tools they need to do those things.
One of the things that we do at the Program for Infant Toddler Care at Wested is that we work with highly motivated teachers who anticipate, because of the kind of training that we do, that there'll be time for them to reflect on their practice, that they're going to be documenting what they're doing, they're going to analyze it, they're going to observe, they're going to get into notions about what is that child's hypothesis and how can I support him testing it out. That's sophisticated stuff. And we've sold the field that this is the work. You know, it isn't babysitting anymore. This is the work. It's great for brain development. It's great for general development.
Right.
Then what we see is when we try to get the programs to set aside some time, even some of the Blue Ribbon programs, it's always worried about, no, they need to be on the floor with the children. And there's not enough money to have a sub come in or have a supervisor stay with the children while these people are doing their planning of the lessons for the next day. And I think that part of that is we have underestimated the cost of really good quality care.
Absolutely.
We have to plan for thinking time for the teachers. We have to plan for teachers to watch a video of their behavior and find out how they might change things. We need for them to be able to talk about, you know, I don't know what happened there. Can you as my colleague help me out with that? And that's a profession.
That's right.
And what we're doing is saying, we want now a profession, but we're not putting the money there to have people enter into a truly professional behavior.
And we have professional expectations and not professional conditions.
Exactly.
And, you know, many years ago, I taught at University of California at Davis in their infant toddler lab, and we'd work with kids would be there for 3 hours a day, and then I would meet with the students afterwards, and we would do just the kinds of things. We kind of look at the day and what happened and how we could have done things differently. We videoed people, all of that. And then those students went out and got jobs in early childhood programs, and they came back, they were furious with me because they're saying, you can't do this in the world. It isn't structured that way. And I think that even around quality improvement systems that people are doing now, They don't make part of a quality program being that you set those professional conditions. They don't build that in. And, you know, some of it's a money thing. We have a tool where we ask teachers to rate their work environments. And one of the questions we ask them is, do you have time to spend with individual children? Do you have time to do sort of more complex projects? And then we ask when do they do their documentation and their reflection. And I think you're just exactly right. Because we used to think of the work as unskilled and not professional, and we haven't really changed the jobs, we still have a structure that's not really there, but we're still asking the teachers to do it. And that is stressful to the teachers, you know? And
I've had teachers say to me, I don't even want more money. I want more time to do my profession. Mm-hmm. I want some release time so that I can think about this work, so that I can analyze what's going on during the day and make decisions about tomorrow.
Right.
So we have a long way to go.
Right. You know, you've heard me say this, but if you really look at the science and you think about working with infants and toddlers, just take our babies first, it's such rich, complex, fascinating work that really requires you to understand so many facets of development and have so many strategies at, you know, and you have to know how to talk to parents and just all sorts of things. And it could be such an engaging, important 21st century middle class profession. But right now, young people look at working with preschoolers, let alone infants and toddlers, as a pathway to poverty. Why would they do that? They can't pay back their student loans. They wouldn't be really well respected for the work they do. One of the things I love about the For Our Babies campaign is we have to really turn the way we think about this work and this period of life on its head and really get a critical mass of us to say we have to do it differently.
There's many interesting situations, but one is unique is that we have this double whammy of we don't have paid parental leave, so that means children go into infant care much earlier than in other industrialized countries, and they're more vulnerable. And then we don't pay the teachers well, and sometimes those teachers are not equipped to deal with the attachment needs of these children who are being pulled from their primary attachment into a secondary attachment, which is a very subtle thing for the caregiver to have to absorb and understand.
Right.
And so it's not just that we're not paying our caregivers enough, is that we're putting children into care earlier and earlier ages, so that it's making the job even more difficult.
Right. And doing that puts enormous stress on parents, because they go through the pain of having to separate from their children and, you know, worrying about their children. And
but, I mean, there are things that we could do if
absolutely.
We have the will. You know, we could have paid parental leave up until 9 months of age at least, and then we would have a transition into childcare where what happens is a similar kind of a relationship is built, not as intense as the parent relationship,
right. But
there's primary care and continuity in a way that we kind of create this protective, womb-like experience that the child can continue to blossom in. And what the scientists are telling us is that's what they need.
That's right.
They need that in order to have their brains grow in a non-stress-filled environment.
So now the question is, how do we take that science and that knowledge that we have and bring that in to inform and change the reality that we currently have on the ground? And, you know, you've heard me talk about, you know, the connection between, like, the drought in California, people, the client, we've always had droughts, but it's worse now, and we have to stop doing certain things, start doing new things, and innovate. And I think the same could be said about early childhood. We have a drought. It's always been this way, in a sense, but now, given the science, we know that it's worse. And like some of the climate change issues that are human-made, I mean, that we've created some of this. Some of our early childhood drought is human-made, too. And so we have to stop saying that this is okay. We have to stop tolerating this, start thinking about the kind of policies you're suggesting, and then innovate sort of how we go about getting those paid for and supported by and carried as a responsibility of all of us, not just putting it on parents and childcare workers.
I think we need a level of sophistication. The brain research has told us that we need someone there for the child once the child goes outside the home in infancy, who is much more sophisticated in their understanding of development than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
We just can't say a babysitter is fine. We know that language development, intellectual development, social emotional development are linked to that. And that has to be paid for by society, or else we're going to be paying for it later on.
Right. And, you know, the other thing I think a lot about, too, is that maybe we need to really start figuring out a way to get child development classes into the high school curriculum so that people understand. So I went to whoever does the advanced placement classes, and I said, I want to get an advanced placement class in child development, because I thought, well, what if you could get that so that people in high school would take that and just learn this stuff then? And they were like, oh, well, you know, it's very political. There's a long line, and, you know, you'd have to get rid of Latin and Greek and a lot of other things before you could get it. But I do think we have to also think about how do we get the next generation of parents understanding this in a much deeper way.
Back in the 1970s, we were pushing for that.
Mm-hmm.
We were pushing for child development classes in junior high school and high school.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Ziegler, who was head of the Office of Child Development at the time, Yale University, was pushing for it. And we came pretty close. But I think that is one of the things that we need to have child rearing as an important part of the education of human beings in this country. It isn't just this thing you do on the side.
Thank you for joining us today on the For Our Babies podcast. If you want to know more about our campaign or to get involved, please visit our website at forourbabies.org. This has been Julie Weatherston, looking out for a brighter future for our babies. See you next time.